Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, April the 9th. We will talk this hour with the author of the best-selling book, Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions, who says we not only make astonishing simple mistakes every day, we make the same types of mistakes. We consistently overpay, underestimate, and procrastinate. And the behaviors are not random or senseless. They are systematic and predictable. Like, he knows why we buy things we don't need and why we can't resist the buy one, get one free sale. He knows why we start diets but only cave in when we see that piece of chocolate cake. And why we think expensive coffee is better coffee, or that expensive pill is better than the cheaper pill. We welcome your questions for him and maybe even your own experiences along these lines. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Dan Ariely. He is a professor of behavioral economics at MIT and is the author of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So what exactly is behavioral economics?
So behavioral economics is a study that is similar to economics in terms of the questions that it looks at, saving and spending and healthcare and so on, but it doesn't assume that people are rational. So economic theory, standard economic theory, assume people are rational, and that's the starting point. We in behavioral economics actually try to start by observation of people in the world, either in the lab or in field studies, and as a consequence, we find very different things, and we make very different predictions, and most importantly, we think very differently about policy. Okay. So, for example, think about the recent subprime mortgage crisis.
Okay.
There's a question of what did we assume that people could do in this situation, and how should we set up the policy? So here's a story. Mm-hmm. I have a position in the Federal Reserve Bank, and my job there is to argue with the local economists from time to time.
Okay.
And a few years ago, there was a question of interest-only mortgages. Now, interest-only mortgages allow people to either borrow more, or they allow them to borrow more flexibly. And every month they can decide if they want to pay just the principal or also pay something towards just the interest or also pay toward the principal. So from a standard economics perspective, this is a good thing because you give people more flexibility. Okay, because you can decide mm-hmm. every month how much you want to spend to pay back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from a behavioral economics perspective, this depends very much on people's rationality in two ways. First, it suggests that if you could get an interest-only mortgage, you would not necessarily borrow more. You would borrow the same. You would buy the same part of the house, and you would just use the money smarter. And secondly, it assumes that people would actually pay back some other things or use the money wiser. And there was an interesting evidence that people with higher credit card debt were more likely to take interest-only mortgages. Now, there are two ways to interpret this. From a standard economic perspective, you would say these are smart people.
Mm-hmm.
They have this expensive debt, and what they choose to do is to get these very smart loan that the government is subsidizing, and they can charge the interest over the taxes and so on, and they will use that extra money to pay off their credit card debt. But from my perspective, you could say this is not necessarily the case. It could be that these people would not necessarily pay off the credit card debt. They, in fact, would get loans that are too big. They will pay the same amount of monthly payment, but only toward the interest. They will have no money to pay back. And as a consequence, something very bad could happen. Now, I can't say I predicted this terrible stock market situation, but I do think that we relied so heavily on people's rationality to figure out mm-hmm. for themselves how much they should borrow that it just became very, very difficult. And here's a question for you. Imagine that you were on the market today for a house. What is the optimal amount of mortgage you should be taking?
I don't know.
I mean, in fact, it's really hard to calculate, mm-hmm. right? You have to think about a lot of things and how to take them into account. So what do we do instead? We go to the bank and we say, how much can we borrow? Uh-huh. And the bank said 30%. Now, that represents the bank's willingness to take risk. It's not what you should be borrowing, right? It's on their calculation. So it's the maximum you can borrow, but it doesn't mean it's the right amount. But because it's so difficult to figure out, you go ahead and you say, well, that's what I'll borrow. And if you got a mortgage with interest only, you might still borrow. You will borrow more because your monthly payment will be lower. They will actually let you borrow more money. So the real issue is that when we come to create policies about healthcare, financial, all kinds of things, we assume that people are super rational. And as a consequence, I think we set ourselves up. Mm. And maybe an interesting kind of analogy is with the physical world. You know, when we design physical products, shoes, car, chairs, pens, whatever, we don't assume that we're all supermen. We assume that we have some specific physical limitations and some specific physical abilities, and we kind of understand what we can and can't do. Somehow, when it comes to the mental domain, to thinking, we assume that we're infallible, that we're like supermen of the mind, that we can't make mistakes, that we're always rational, and so on. In some sense, it's more strange that we assume that we are rational than the discovery that we are not rational. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what the field is about.
It's fascinating stuff, and a lot of the research you did too is fascinating. Does this mean that we are irrational and there's just accept it? There's nothing we can do about it. That's the way things are.
Well, I think in some sense there is, and in some sense there isn't. So, you know, we're human. And human mean we're not infallible in the same way that in the physical domain we're not infallible. Now, can we do something about it? I think there's all kinds of things we can think about. And maybe there are kind of three categories of things we can do about it. It turns out that there's one way to be rational, and there's many, many ways to be irrational. So there are many types of mistakes we can do. Right, procrastination, attempted to be too free, having unsafe sex, getting into bad habits, not saving. I mean, there's just a lot of them. So there's no silver magic bullet that would just fix everything. But if we look at those behaviors, if we try to learn about them, there are some behaviors we can learn to avoid. So there's some warning signs. So for example, for me, it's the case of free. It turns out that free often puts us into the wrong path, and now when I see free, I just slow down, I think about it.
Buy one, get one free might not be a deal.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Or get the free checking account, you know, might cost me more in the long run. And I might actually make a better decision. There are other things that I know that if I'll get to that situation, I'll lose the battle. So I try not to get to this situation. For example, have you ever gone to a supermarket hungry as a consequence got too much food?
Yeah, all the time.
That's right. It doesn't just happen once. It happens all the time. It's very hard to learn from this experience not to repeat it again.
Yeah, but I did read that I should go to the supermarket on a full stomach and then I won't buy the Twinkies.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So there are tools that we can learn to overcome things. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then there's the third idea, which is thinking about mechanisms that would help us. So think about retirement saving or saving in general. From an economic perspective, it would be good to save at the end of the month. You will get your entire salary at the beginning of the month. You would use it, and at the end of the month, whatever is left, you would send to your saving account. But of course, we know it doesn't work. So what do? We do automatic deductions from our paycheck. In some sense, we limit our freedom and our flexibility, but we know that if we leave it to our own decision every time, we will not save. So we take it out of our control, and we create a situation in which we force ourselves to save. Okay? Is that a bad thing? No, it's a great thing. The moment we understand that this is an important thing, we can actually think about how we create more and more tools like that.
Yeah. And
Sorry, I
was just going to say you made me start thinking about the retirement account mailings that we just received in the mail, and of course we were shocked at how much money we've lost over the last 3 months from our retirement accounts. And
yeah.
I'm wondering what if it's rational for us to be putting all this money into a thing called the stock market that does these kinds of things.
Well, you know, so first of all, I think that. From my perspective, the stock market has clearly demonstrated how irrational we are.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about it, we now realize what structural mistakes there were in the stock market. You know, that the bankers were selling mortgages to individuals and having what is called asymmetry of information. They knew more than the individuals who were getting it. And then they went ahead and in the back sold it again as banking products to other companies, and again had asymmetry of information. So there was some real structural problem, and you can ask, how can it be that the place that should be the most rational in the whole world, the stock market, involves trillions of dollars, millions of people, everybody's trying to make a penny over other people. How can it be that that institution is not ideal? But let me tell you something about retirement. I think it's, you know, we're clearly under-saving as a nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the issue is that we got used to, or we saw in the past, these very high returns in the stock market,
mm-hmm.
10, 20% a year, that makes it very non-palatable for us to save now when we get 3% a year. But, you know, even if we got 0%, it's still important to save.
Right.
Retirement is incredibly important. It's becoming increasingly more expensive. We live longer. And healthcare costs are going to be kind of frightening.
Yeah. I need to take a short pause and remind listeners that we are talking with Dan Ariely. He is a professor of behavioral economics at MIT and the author of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. If you have a question about why we do what we do, and have you ever asked yourself, what was I thinking? Well, Professor Ariely might have an answer for you. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up later this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. And after 5, Ben and his guest talk about the U.S. healthcare system and how it compares with other democracies. Ben will talk with a guest from the Frontline documentary, Sick Around the World, after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking with Dan Ariely. He is author of Predictably Irrational. 1-800-642-1234. If you'd like to join in the conversation, maybe with your questions about the decisions we make and why we do things like buy things we don't need. Maybe you even have some confessions or experiences. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Professor Ariely, I wanted you, there are lots of interesting research in your book, experiments that you conducted, including, talk a little bit, one that stands out was when you had kids drink beer, one laced with balsamic vinegar and one that wasn't. Tell us about that.
So we set up a little booth in the local pubs, in two pubs, and we gave people two small samples of beer. One was a regular beer, one was beer with balsamic vinegar. And we asked them, drink those two and tell us which one you like better, and we'll give you a big glass of the one that you prefer.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly, people thought that the one with vinegar was actually better. So they chose it much more frequently. But then we did another version in which we told people up front, here are two glasses of beers. One is with balsamic vinegar, one is without. This one has it, this one doesn't have it. So now they knew. It was not blind tasting, but they knew. And now they hated it. And it didn't matter how much they tasted of the small samples, they still hated it. And the question, of course, is what is reality? You know, when they expected to hate something, they hated it.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience itself, even though it was better from the blind tasting, did not correct it. And there's an interesting question of how much what we believe to be reality actually turns out to be reality. And I'll give you another example. we did the same version of the experiment, same type of experiment, with painkillers. Mm-hmm. We brought people to the lab. We told them we have a new drug called Veladone RX. We had pens with the logo of the companies and brochures and all kinds of things. We measured their blood pressure, their family history, and so on. Then we connected them to a device that gave them electrical shocks, and we measured how much pain they could tolerate, how much painful each of these shocks were to them.
Ouch!
Yeah. Then we gave them a pill that turned out to be a placebo pill, a pill which actually was vitamin C in our case. We gave them 15 minutes next to old Time and Newsweek magazines so they could, you know, feel really like a doctor's office.
Yeah, right.
And then we again gave them the same set of electrical shocks. Now, two things happened. The first one is that they felt pain relief. Okay, and that's basically the known placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just so you realize, the placebo effect is real. It's really in the sense that we understand its physiology quite well. So it turns out that when a physician injects you with some saline water or you pop a Tylenol or something, your body secretes a substance that is very much like morphine. Okay? You have this substance inside of your brain, and you can secrete it. You can create it. You can distribute it. But you can't do it at will. You can't close your eyes and say, please, please, can I have some painkillers? That doesn't work. But when something external happens, for example, a doctor is giving you an injection, your body does that. So in fact, the placebo is a very interesting case in which the body changes its physiology in reaction to the world and actually changing the future state. Now, the other thing we did, so that was the regular placebo study, people just feigned relief.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we did was we gave people different brochures about the painkiller. Some people told it was cheap. Some people told it was expensive. Some people was told it was cheap and made in China. Some people told it was expensive and made in China, cheap and made in the U.S., or expensive and made in the U.S. The question was, would this information about the pill, for example, would the price of the pill, would influence the extent of the placebo effect? And the result was very much so. In particular, the price worked very strongly. So people who thought that the pill was discounted, was cheaper, actually felt much less pain relief. Their expectations about the pill being cheap penetrated their expectation about the efficacy of the pill, and as a consequence, they didn't get as much benefit out of it.
Is that why we want a brand name rather than a generic?
That's right. So, mm-hmm. you could look all you want in the back of the pill and see that they're exactly the same. It's still the case that the brand name versus generic could still give you a bigger benefit.
Yeah. What role does marketing or advertising play in this? Any at all?
Huge. I mean, mm-hmm. this is what creates expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about what is your expectation built on, is about what you heard about the pill, what you think about it, and so on. And it actually blends the borders between marketing and reality. So, you know, about a month ago, there was a study that showed that most of the antidepressant medications work just as well as placebo. Not for the people who are very depressed, but for everybody else. And it's not because the medications are not good. It's because placebo is so good. Now, what is happening is that it's all a game of expectations. The moment you expect something to be good, you approach it differently, your body reacts differently to it, and as a consequence, the reality that is the outcome can be different.
Yeah. Oh, let me get some callers in. Mike in Madison joins us first. Hi, Mike.
This is just a fascinating topic and a great guest. You know, I guess I always wonder about, I've always wondered about economics. I find it interesting. I don't understand it. But, you know, one of the things that strikes me is that we're assuming this rational behavior, as you guessed us. And if you look at what corporations, particularly now, who you think would be rational entities, it seems that so much now is being driven by short-term rather than any kind of a long-term view. And I'm wondering, you know, if your guest has looked at that or how that plays into things when you look at sort of short-term return or rewards as opposed to a longer horizon.
Yeah, so it's a very good question. You know, there are many cases in which it's hard to differentiate whether somebody is rational or whether somebody is making a mistake. So the focusing of different companies on the short term, it's hard to differentiate sometimes whether it's because the way that we reward these people is by their stock portfolio on a quarterly basis. And because of that, the horizon is just for one quarter. But in fact, we do have results, not about CEOs, but we do have results about people focusing very much on the short term and the idea that the short term is very different for us than the long term. And let me give you an example. Imagine I offered you two things. I said, would you rather have a half a box of chocolate right now? And
yes.
I open it for you and you saw it. Or you want a full box of chocolate in a week? What would you choose?
Yeah, I'd want it now.
You want it now. So in some sense, you're telling me that it's not worthwhile for you to wait a week for an extra half a box of chocolate.
Yeah.
How about if I push those things to the future? And I said, what would you rather have? A half a box of chocolate in a year or a full box of chocolate in a year and a week?
Well, I might wait that week.
There you go. But you understand it's the same trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, you're saying, oh, it's definitely worthwhile waiting a week for another half a box of chocolate. Now, a year from now, you would be in the same situation. You could have said, I could have had the chocolate right now, but I have to wait another week. But what is happening is that when things are here and now, mm-hmm. they create an emotional response. You can smell the chocolate. You can feel it. It's close to you. And as a consequence, the future looks very far, and you just want what's in the present. When it's in the future, you don't have any emotion about it. You can think very cognitive about it. So in regard to the caller's question, I think there are two issues. One is I think we reward people wrongly from a rational perspective, often for short-term performances. But the second thing is we have this tendency to focus incredibly by ourselves on the short-term consequences and ignore the long-term kind of thinking.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike, for the call. Next, we go to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you. I just noticed in our local paper today that there is a half-page ad for a large SUV, a Cadillac Escalade, that cost over $100 a tank to fill at the pump, offering $10,000 discount in big red block on this half-page ad. In another part of the paper, it shows that the city council approved electric vehicles to operate on city streets for the first time. With this dissonance of people needing to drive these golf carts on the streets, what kind of psychology is appealing to people to buy these? In fact, this Escalade, it's the 07 model that was dated 6 months ago. They're still trying to sell. What kind of psychology is appealing to people to buy these old Escalades, even for a $10,000 discount?
So one of the most kind of strong factors that determine our behavior is about habits. And maybe it's a good way to think about it in driving. So imagine, remember when you started driving, how difficult it was to drive and change the radio station, or you had to focus on every stop sign and every turn. But over time, it became more automatic. You stopped thinking about it very mm-hmm. carefully, and you just started doing it. In fact, probably when you drove yesterday home, you didn't even notice anything about the traffic light or mm-hmm. where you were. It was automatic. Now, it turns out that this is a very good skill of our body to make things automatic, to make things out of our immediate control that don't demand our attention and so on. But it also turns out it has a curse. And the curse is that if we make a bad decision, we're likely to repeat that decision. We're not likely to think about it very carefully. And also, it turns out that if we make a decision that was good in one environment, for example, in a situation where oil was cheap, we might still do it because we don't think about it very carefully. So I think that actually explains kind of one of the traps of us just doing things over and over and over in the same way, and partially because it's so hard to evaluate situations every time. So that's what I suspect is happening. We've been just been used for too long to buy large cars, and it's very hard to break that habit.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot,
Thank
Steve,
you.
For the call. And now Tom in Mequon. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Interesting show. Please bear with me when I try and describe my question. I'm wondering if your doctor has any thoughts on this. In the thinking and research that I've done on this, it seems to me that the body responds first. In that, it may be emotional, or maybe just your first thought. I think is like the basic of your being. It might be your your brain or something like that, or your mind. But then a few moments later, you'll think about things, you'll contemplate things. It'll give you a chance to rationally, you know, view things and think, well, maybe things aren't as bad as what I thought at first. Like if something, you know, scared you, that'll overcome all your thoughts for that moment. And then those first thoughts are maybe emotional thoughts where they're, irrational or rude, or maybe you're upfront in your mind. You know, you want to tell somebody off, or you're just not kind. But then, after a few moments, you think, "Well, you know, it's really not as bad as what I think." And I was wondering what you might thought thought about that.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What's your name?
Tom.
Tom.
Yes.
Hi, Tom. So can I? I hope I'm not going to embarrass you. Okay, but let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Imagine that you have. I'm going to ask you a simple math problem, okay?
Okay.
A baseball bat and a baseball ball cost together $1.10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The bat cost a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost?
Seemingly 10 cents.
Okay. Now, what you've done is you followed your gut reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It was, together they're $1.10, the bat is a dollar more than the ball, you said 10 cents. It's actually the wrong answer. If you thought about it for a second, you would realize that. If the bat is a dollar more than the ball, and the ball is 10 cents, a dollar more will be $1.10, together they will be $1.20. In fact, the ball is 5 cents. 5 cents plus $1.05 is $1.10. Now, this is not difficult math, right? It's not a question that you would not be able to do that if you thought about it for 2 seconds, but what you've just shown is exactly the point you made, that many times in decision-making, we have this very strong gut feeling, and the question is, are we going to revisit it, rethink about it, and come up with a different answer?
Mm-hmm.
And the situation, as you suggest, is that often we don't. We have a strong gut feeling. I'll give you another example. I'm not going to embarrass you with another question now, but
that's okay.
You know, imagine that you go on a first date with somebody.
Yes.
And you just don't find them that attractive. Would you ever go on a second date with them just to figure out if your first impression is wrong? Very unlikely, right? You have a very strong first impression, a very strong gut reaction, and you're very unlikely to tell yourself, well, maybe I'm a bad judge of character, maybe first date is not that indicative. So it's absolutely the case that we have first gut reactions, and they're very strong, and they can influence our decisions very dramatically. It's also the case that if we revisit those things, we could learn better, but under most situations, we don't.
One more thing.
Yes, Tom, go ahead.
I'm wondering, could it be possibly the right brain versus left brain, or is it maybe your body versus your spirit or soul? Maybe the soul is actually what's thinking, but your body's what's reacting.
I'm
wondering if you thought about that.
So the general way we think about it is emotion versus cognition. I think there's probably many ways you can think about it, and probably multiple one of them are valid. But if you think about the initial thing about the limbic system, about your gut feeling is actually in the part of the brain that that is evolutionary, has been with us for a long time. You know, if you were an animal in the jungle, a few thousand years ago, and you saw a tiger, you don't want to start thinking, should I run, shouldn't I run, what's the benefit, what's the cost, where am I standing? You wanted a system that takes over, that sees a tiger, gets you not to think, takes all the blood from all the things that are not important right now in your body and makes you run as fast as you can away from that. And it turns out we still have this system, this very reasonable system for evolution called emotion. We still have it, but right now it causes us, you know, to fight with our spouse and to have road rage and to be frightened when the stock market goes down and take all our money out of there. It's not as useful as it used to be, but you can see how evolutionary it was, very important to create a system that worked without thinking.
Tom, thanks very much for the call. And if it makes you feel any better, I too thought the ball was 10 cents, but I knew it was wrong. I just couldn't figure out.
You think this would get people not to call now?
No. There's still some callers, and we'll invite others as well. But I wanted to ask you, since you just reminded me of this, in terms of that first date and first impressions, I heard a study just yesterday that said that the average guy, I think it's in this country, takes 3 years to pop the question. That if the guy pops the question, it takes a full 3 years. And I'm thinking, that's a long time, isn't it?
Yes. And I think part of the issue is, so one of the things we write about is the issue of having too many options open. And think about the idea of when do you decide that marriage is basically closing options open. You promise not to look at other alternatives. And it turns out that in general we have this very difficult strategy of closing doors. You know, when undergrads go to college, they try to major in multiple things. They don't want to close any doors. When we date, people juggle. They try to date too many people, particularly online. And by doing so, of course, we hurt the main relationship that we're in. Because if I am dating one person I think is the person who I'm going to live the rest of my life with, but I have two other women that I'm kind of keeping on the side just in case, the effort I need to spend on these other two women hurts my main relationship. But it turns out that we're so afraid of closing doors that we just delay it and delay it and delay it. Now, I don't know if 3 years is too little or, you know, too long. It depends for who and so on. But in general, I can tell you that we have this bias of not willing to commit early enough and spending too much time keeping options open. And as a consequence, we end up losing in our experiments. People lose money. In life, people lose all kinds of other things, of course.
We are talking with Dan Ariely. He is the Alfred P. Sloan Professor of Behavioral Economics at MIT. And he is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions, in which he says that not only do all of us make simple mistakes every day, we make the same kinds of mistakes, the same types of mistakes, and we consistently overpay, underestimate, procrastinate, and that these behaviors, these decisions are not random. They're systematic and predictable, and he knows why. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock, talking with her guests about General Petraeus's testimony before Congress yesterday about the situation in Iraq. So more on that coming up after 9. We're talking with Professor Dan Ariely, who is the author of Predictably Irrational. And before we go back to the phones, I had promised at the top of the hour, Professor Ariely, to ask you about why we keep on going back for second helpings at the buffet when our stomachs are full. Why did I do that at the Indian buffet this weekend?
Well, part of the issue is that it's free. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, it's just very, very tempting. I mean, we can imagine I had a restaurant and I said, I'm not trying to imagine the opposite of the buffet. Imagine I had a restaurant and I figured out that people take 25 bites and I charge them $25 on average. Mm-hmm. And one day I offered you a deal and I said, today I'm only going to charge you 50 cents per bite, but I'm going to stand next to you and I'm going to charge you per bite. So every time you take a bite, I'll mark a V on my page, and at the end of the day, I'll count how many Vs they haven't charged you. How much fun will that be?
Right? Not at all. Yeah.
Now, that's the opposite of a buffet, that every bite counts, and as a consequence, the joy of eating goes down. The other interesting thing that happened in the buffet is the variety. So it turns out that if you eat one food, every additional bite is slightly less pleasurable. You know, the first bite of creme brulee is fantastic, the second one is less, and so on. But it turns out that if you have a new food coming in, you start this decrease from start. So actually, a good recipe for dieting in general is to eat just one thing, because the enjoyment is decreasing faster. And the more little things you can try, the more your appetite starts lower. By the way, the same thing happens with rats and mice and sex. If you take two mice and you put them in a cage and they have sex for a while, and then the male rat gets tired, like, you know, seem exhausted, you put a new female in, they're just kind of rejuvenated completely and start the process from scratch. So this variety actually increase our stamina and our ability.
Yeah, and why do we prefer the $5 cup of coffee to the 50-cent cup of Joe at the diner?
So there are a few things happening there. One is the price issue we discussed earlier, mm-hmm. is that many times we don't actually know how much value we're getting out of something. Like, think about a piece of Godiva chocolate. It's melting in your mouth, you mm-hmm. smell it, it's the aroma is wonderful, the sweetness and so on. And now I say, and how much is it worth to you? How much in dollars? You can probably tell me how much you paid for it, how much mm-hmm. it should cost, how much. But if I ask you how much utility, how much pleasure you're getting out of it,
priceless.
It turns out it's incredibly hard to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do instead? We rely on external cues. We rely on things that are not about our pleasure. Things like what kind of restaurant it's served in, what kind of cup it's served in, and so on. And those things have an influence. In fact, we tested once. We sold coffee for a while at the MIT cafeteria. Actually, we gave coffee away. And we had the coffee. We had, you know, cream and sugar and half and so on. And then we had these condiments that nobody uses. Anise,
paprika.
paprika, that's right. Paprika, anise, all kinds of things like that. And nobody ever used them, but we varied the type of container they were in. Sometimes they were like in executive-looking metal and glass containers, and sometimes they were in styrofoam cups with kind of ugly cut edges, hand-cut edges. And nobody used them. They shouldn't have mattered, but they did matter a lot.
Coffee tasted better if they were in crystal cups.
That's right. The coffee tasted better. They're willing to pay more. They want the cafeteria to carry it more. They drank more. I mean, there's things about the environment that really influence how we think about something.
Let's get to some more callers. Mark in Green Bay. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the opportunity. Professor Ayali, I'd like you to go back to your example of the placebo effect, but take it from a different perspective. What if you would have put the warning on the package that said this could cause nausea or this could do some other thing like the black box warning that they have on prescriptions? Would that wipe out the placebo effect and induce people to have hypochondriac symptoms, or how would that work?
Yeah, so very much as you suggest. So it turns out that we have side effects all the time. You know, I don't know about you, I walk today and my neck is, you know, slightly more stiff than it was yesterday, or my finger is a little bit more aching. I mean, we have all kinds of little things happen all the time. And it turns out that when we give people even placebo and we tell them that those have side effects, all of a sudden they attribute every ailment they have to that side effect. They notice it more, they think about it more, and as a consequence, they actually have more kind of influential side effects. So you're absolutely right about that.
Thank you, Mark. Now we go to Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning, Joey. Dr. Dan, I'll shorten it. I can't pronounce the last name.
Hey, nobody can. Don't worry about it.
I have something that I haven't heard mentioned yet when factoring in a decision of a distant reward or a near reward, and that is the age of the person making the decision. I'll give you a case in point. Both of my parents died quite young, and I look at the reasons for it, and I think, well, I may be subject to that. So would I rather have a short trip this month to somewhere in the U.S., or would I rather have my fantasy trip to Moscow or Peking in a year? Does age enter into these decisions?
Yeah. So let me say a few general things. First of all, in general, we don't find many differences with age. There are some small differences, but not large ones. So the general phenomena is the same. We also haven't tested enough older individuals. I've done a few attempts. There are people who are focusing on that. There haven't been enough, partially because it's very hard to get to this, but we do hope to get some support from AARP and some individuals who are writing me these days and to learn more about that. So the one thing we know that happens with age is that people shift their focus from negative things to positive things. So, for example, if you take an older individual and you show them a set of pictures, some of them are negative and some of them are positive, they will have better memory for the positive than for the negative ones, whereas young people would have a better memory for the negative one than the positive one. So there seemed to be a shift of attention toward positive things and away from negative things. And, of course, the big problem with that is that from a marketing perspective, it might be that older individuals might actually be more susceptible to different marketing information because they don't focus as much on the negative side or the side effects or the less appealing aspect of the product.
Thank you, Mike, for the call. Now Jordan in Richland Center is with us. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, thank you so much. This is a fascinating show, and it's so interesting that Professor Arruela, you know, has evidence for his statements. Anyway, I had two questions. One is you mentioned the some of the decision-making mechanisms that we have, like the limbic system. And my question is really, is the mind, is there evidence that we're sort of evolving somehow? Are things changing in our minds as the environment and our world changes, or is it staying just the same way it was, 100,000 years ago? That's one question. The other is about habits. Everybody is faced, so many people at least, are faced with wanting to change a habit, you know, to start an exercise program, to lose weight, to meditate, whatever. And you have that challenge. How do you get yourself to do things and change your habits?
Yeah, help me with that, too.
Okay, so the two questions. First of all, evolutionary, are we changing? We don't have good evidence of this. What is for sure is that we're not changing fast enough. I mean, think about the invention of money. You know, has the brain, has our evolution been sufficiently different in the last couple of thousand years to catch up with this new invention of money? Unlikely. Of course, you know, hedge funds and all of those things for sure could not be caught by evolution. So even if we do change, evolution is way too slow to take into account all the things we create in medicine and healthcare and the financial instruments that we're carrying. So evolution is, you know, there might be something better in the future when we could actually start thinking rationally about money, but right now we're not there, and by the time we get there, money will probably be very different than what it is now. The second question about habits. I'll tell you two things about how to think about habits. The first one is a little experiment we did with retirees. And some years ago, AARP spent about $4 million trying to get people to walk more. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that a single step resulted from this advertising campaign they did. But we basically said, okay, look, people should care about walking, but they somehow don't. Let's think about what they do care about. And we say people care about social relationship, and if they have a meeting with somebody, they don't want to stand them up. So we created a little tool that allowed people to schedule easily meetings with other people to meet them on street corners to go for a walk. And it turns out that when people had the meeting scheduled, they actually went for this walk. So what we've done there, and we actually created a very useful tool, and people started walking more. Now, what we've done here is we've basically taken something that people should care about but don't seem to care about with something that people do care about, not standing a friend waiting in the street corner and waiting, and we marry them together by putting a simple technology of scheduling together. And as a consequence, we got what we wanted and I think what people wanted. So that's one approach, is to basically say, how do I bring into the equation something that people that would actually motivate people. I'll tell you a story. I was in hospital for many years as a burn patient, and one of the things I got out of the hospital was a chronic liver disease. Mm. So there was a year when I had to give myself injections of interferon. Interferon is a very unpleasant medication. Every injection would get me sick for about a day, and I would have to give myself this injection three times a week. So I would give an injection, I would, in a couple of hours, I would start vomiting and have high fever and so on. And it's very hard to give yourself an injection that would cause yourself to feel so badly. And it turns out I love movies. So what I did was I said, I'm only going to watch a movie after I take the injection. And then before I went to take the injection, I went to the movie store, I looked for the movie I wanted, I would make myself comfortable, I would give myself the injection, and I would put the movie in, and as a consequence, I was able to, you know, sustain this thing for a year. Now, what I did was basically creating a reward that worked very well with a particular kind of punishment I had to give to myself, and therefore I was able to sustain this.
Yeah. Do you still have to give yourself those injections?
No. It was just for a year. It just for a year, and thankfully it worked.
But you can apply that to other other things. Reward yourself for losing 5 pounds, or reward yourself for whatever.
For losing, it's very hard because it's the outcome. I don't want you to people to reward themselves for the outcome, but for the behavior.
Okay.
You know, I didn't want to reward myself if I get rid of this liver disease. You want to say, when I exercise, I'm going to marry it with something useful. The reward comes later. It's probabilistic. It fluctuates. You want to reward the behavior, not the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
There's one more way to think about it, and I'll tell you a story about procrastination. So as a university professor, you know, procrastination is something I see all the time. In the beginning of the semester, all my students are eager and excited, and they come with clean notebooks, and they promise to be ahead of the reading every week. And toward the end of the semester, you know, there are dead relatives and strange diseases and all kinds of things and excuses that they need.
Right when the deadline is. Yeah.
That's right. So for a couple of years, I offered them a deal. I said, look, this year, I'm giving you an opportunity to set your own deadlines. You owe me 3 papers, and you can decide today when you're going to submit each of those papers. Mm-hmm. It could be any day in the term. Now, if the students were rational, they should have said, the semester ends May 2nd, I'll submit all the papers on May 2nd. Because when I told them these deadlines, if they were late, they would pay a penalty. They would lose a grade point for each day that they're late. So why should they take this penalty? However, if the students were irrational, if they were procrastinators, if they knew that if the semester ends May 2nd, they will start working on this thing May 1st, work the whole night and get bad results, they might actually space the deadlines out, and they might actually get better results. And the reality is that that's what happened. They spaced the deadlines, and they actually got to perform better. And that, in general, is what we call self-control mechanisms. Is it mechanisms that we think about once, and we try to work with them, and then we can actually force ourselves to behave better later on.
Mm. And one last, we might not have time for this, but Lauren and Holman emailed, why do people gamble when they know they're going to lose? Can you answer that quickly in less than a minute?
So Skinner has shown that if you take animals in a maze, in a box, and you give them a pellet of food for every 10 pecks they do, it's rewarding. But if you give it to them on a random schedule of reinforcement, sometimes it's 1, sometimes it's 100, it's much more tempting, it's addictive, and they keep on doing it for a very, very long time, even when you take the reward away. And that's basically what gambling is. It's taking the same paradigm, just applying it to our everyday behavior and to us losing money.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at MIT. He is the author of the new book, which is a New York Times bestseller, Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing the hour. Thanks to Christina Taylor for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. Hope you stay tuned. Tomorrow at this time, we will be releasing results of the Wisconsin Public Radio St. Norbert College survey on the presidential race. Who's your favorite candidate and why? That's tomorrow during this hour.